Grab your headphones and some wine. Don't be scared now, you'll be fine. Cause nothing is fact and we're just talking, so come join Weird Things and Wine.
Hello and welcome to Weird Things and Wine, the show where we sip wine and talk about all things weird. My name is Tash.
And my name is Mia.
And today we will be talking about D.B. Cooper. Shall we jump right into it?
Yes, please.
Cheers. Cheers. The 1950s to the 1970s is often regarded as the golden age of air travel. Imagine a luxurious lounge filled with all sorts of displays of finery and wealth. Ladies adorned with silk gloves and strings of pearls, accompanied by gentlemen wearing expensive suits and carrying important leather briefcases.
Ooh.
They'd be sipping champagne and discussing their excitement for the latest form of travel, the airplane. It was an event worth dressing up for, a veritable party in the sky. It's no wonder such a marvel attracted those seeking their fortune, specifically those willing to do anything to get it. So enters Dan Cooper, a man who has been remembered in infamy for his attempted, and potentially successful, skyjacking. His case still has people talking over 50 years later, and is regarded as one of the most intriguing mysteries that has never been solved. Let's talk about D.B. Cooper.
Wow.
Okay, if you hear my cat crying, he's just talkative and 17, so we let him talk. He's got a lot to say.
He's the ambiance for today. Also, let the record show, we're actually drinking wine today. Not a cocktail. We're actually Weird Things and Wine.
For like the first time in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, we're so good at things. Mia, I have a question.
Yes.
Because I know that you do a lot of flying in your life. Oh, lots of airplane flying, at least. Mm-hmm. Do you like flying?
That's a good question. My answer's definitely changed over the years.
Okay.
As of lately, it's maybe not my favorite thing to do. But there are like aspects of flying that I like and don't like also at the same time.
Like what?
Like turbulence.
Oh my gosh.
Like turbulence is fun in the moment, but the idea of impending doom, not so fun.
not so fun.
It's very double-edged.
Have you heard about the Jell-O theory?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
So apparently when a plane is going through turbulence, it's like it's in Jell-O and the Jell-O is shaking, but it's not going to fall through the Jell-O. So basically the air is Jell-O and the plane is in the Jell-O.
That's a great theory.
Yeah, and it makes you feel a little better because it's like you're not just going to jump out of Jell-O. You're okay.
That's fair. I've watched way too many like plane crash documentaries or investigations or just videos about plane crashes.
Oof.
I've watched like a lot. Which is probably why my view of flying is not as it once was as a young child. But
as a child, it's so fun.
It was so much fun. It was like my favorite thing to when the takeoff happens and the like G-forces on you push you back.
Mm.
As a young child, you can't like hold yourself up. So you would like hold for as long as you can and then just finally give in. Oh my gosh. What a blast.
Now it's not so fun.
No, now it's more like white knuckled on the seat, like
if something's going to go wrong, it's gonna happen now.
It's gonna happen within the next 2 minutes. Please can we just get up into air and have the seatbelt sign turned off and then we'll be okay. Do you like flying?
I get really anxious about it. Even though I'm not like too worried about crashing, I get claustrophobic.
Oh, yeah. That's not great.
Like the first time I was ever on an airplane for like seriously on an airplane that I can remember, I was on like a 12-hour flight.
Ooh.
And like halfway through, I was like, okay, I am ready to skydive. Give me a parachute and I will jump out of here right now.
Oh no.
Because there was just too many people.
That's fair.
It's awful.
There's no escaping.
There's no escaping. And then eventually you realize we're all breathing the same air and it's been 12 hours and now I'm breathing someone else's air.
Yeah.
Not good.
That's not the most favorite fact.
No. I'm not really too worried about the actual in the plane type of, or in the sky type of stuff. It's more the other people I don't like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, together, like, we can do this.
Together we can do this. You're fine being in a plane, and I'm fine being in the sky. We'll be okay. So, let's talk about the hijacking. So, on November 24th, 1971, a man known only as D.B. Cooper or Dan Cooper bought a one-way plane ticket from Portland, Oregon to Seattle, Washington. So, he bought this ticket with cash, $20. Can you believe a flight cost $20?
No. Honestly, no.
It's crazy. So, he showed up at the airport, gave them the name Dan Cooper, they didn't need ID back then, and bought the flight with cash. And he carried only a black briefcase and a paper bag that was 4 inches tall, 12 inches wide, and 14 inches long. He was described as a white male in his mid-40s. Cooper was dressed as a businessman, wearing a raincoat over a suit and tie. He was one of 42 people aboard Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305, which was a Boeing 727, six of which were the crew members. So it wasn't a very big flight, or at least not like a populated flight.
The flight actually could carry 106 passengers.
So that's like less than half.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I found that odd. Just because, so like, my mom had been flying during that time. She started flying with her parents and she was very young. And from all the stories that she's told me, like, all of the flights that she's been on, none of them have really ever been, like, have had as little people on it as this flight.
Yeah, I feel like when you get on a flight, you know it's going to be, like, you're brushing shoulders with strangers the whole time. It's, like, never not packed.
And especially because, like, how can you even make money on a flight if you have less than half capacity?
Yeah. Especially back then.
Yeah.
I don't know what $20. I think that'd be about $100 nowadays, which is still cheap for a flight.
Yeah. At any rate, it's cheap for a flight.
Yeah. And back then, of course, there was no, like, security. You don't need to, like, get your bags checked or anything.
No. Which is also crazy.
Yeah. So, Cooper was seated near the last row, and it's debated which seat exactly he sat in.
Mm-hmm.
So, it could have been 18E, it could have been any number of other ones.
Yeah.
It varies. But it was near the last row, near the back of the airplane. And he asked a flight attendant for a bourbon and soda, and was smoking cigarettes basically the whole time. I think he smoked 8 mm-hmm. around in total, which was pretty normal for the time, 1970s.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to drink and you're going to have a cigarette on a plane, which is crazy, again.
Also, yes.
I can't imagine being on an airplane and having someone smoke beside me.
Especially as a non-smoker.
Mm-hmm.
That would just be, like, a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
The Flight 305, so the model is a Boeing 727, which was introduced in 1963. So, like, not too far before this whole thing happened, this plane was introduced into, or it was put into service. And really interestingly, they had to make a change after 1971 to this plane because of this incident.
Right, yeah.
So, just because we're talking about the plane, I will describe one of the most distinct features of the plane, which is that its entrance and exit point was something called an air stair, which I have never seen before in my whole life, which is located at the back of the plane, and it's just a staircase that can be lowered, as opposed to, like, normal planes today have an exit point near the front of the plane where they have to bring a separate staircase to the plane for you to get out, but this one was built in. As I mentioned previously, after 1971, they added something called a Cooper vane, also known as the Dan Cooper switch or the DB Cooper device, which is essentially a mechanism that, when in flight, uses airflow to move something under the door, and the airflow keeps the door from being able to be opened in flight. Or the air stair, not the door.
Which is really nice, because that's reassuring. They should have had that before.
Yeah, I can't believe that they didn't have that before. But I guess it makes sense if they were like, oh, who's gonna jump out of a plane?
That's crazy.
On to more about the Flight 305's plane. There were 6 crew members in total. There was a Captain William Scott, First Officer Bob Ratazak. Sorry. There was a Flight Engineer H.E. Anderson, and there were 2 flight attendants, Tina Mucklow and Florence Schaffner. Also, this is not important or at all relevant to this case, but flight engineers. really neat things that they had to have back in the day. And flight engineers had to be so trained, just like pilots, and they worked together in sync because the flight engineer was in charge of reading all the instruments and inputting anything that the pilots needed, like, we're going to go up, so we need more fuel. Okay, I'll input the fuel that we need. They're also in charge of doing pre-flight and post-flight checks and calculating the weights. Like, they were in charge of, like, all the mechanical systems on a plane.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
It's, like, a lot.
That's really cool.
And it's really sad because you don't see them really anymore.
No.
Computers.
It's computers, man.
Yeah.
AI is taking over everyone's job.
Kind of.
If you're curious about what the stairs look like, there's a really cute animation on the Wikipedia page where you can see, like, the door open in the back of the airplane and Cooper, like, jump out. It's like a little stick figure. It's cute. Check it
Thanks,
out.
Thanks, Wikipedia.
Okay, so the flight left Portland at 2:50 the day before Thanksgiving and was scheduled to arrive in Seattle just 30 minutes later. Just after takeoff, Cooper handed a note to flight attendant Florence Schaffner, who was sitting in the seat behind him. Now, she didn't look at it right away, assuming that it was just his attempt to give her his number, which was not an uncommon thing for flight attendants at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened to her a lot, so she just assumed that it was his number and didn't look at it. That's when Cooper whispered, "Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb."
Casual.
Casual. He was like, okay, well, now this is awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have to tell her.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, Florence opened the paper and saw written in capital letters, "Miss, I have a bomb in my briefcase and I want you to sit by me." She promptly did as instructed and requested to see it. When Cooper opened his briefcase to reveal this bomb, she saw what inside what she assumed was dynamite, wires, and a battery. Cooper then proceeded to give her a short list of demands: $200,000 in American money, almost $1.5 million today, as well as 2 back and 2 front parachutes. He requested that she go and tell the pilot this so he could relay it to the air control on the ground. So she did. She relayed it to Captain William A. Scott, who contacted ground control in Minnesota, which they were flying over at the time.
Also, at this point, there was, like, from what I understood, a pretty, like, a fairly quick succession of phone calls. So the pilot contacted ground control. Ground control contacted the police. Police, the FBI, the airline president, Donald Nyrope? Sorry. And also at this time, the FBI were asking the president, the airline president, what he wanted to do in the situation. Specifically, do you want us to comply? What should we do? And he said to comply.
Right, because at this time, it was kind of left up to the airlines how they dealt with their airline business, whereas nowadays it would be like an FBI sort of call.
Crazy.
Which is insane. What if he had just been like, I'm not giving him $200,000? That's insane. He shouldn't be able to make that choice. There's 42 people on board. So the crew then informed the passengers that there would be a delay in their landing in Seattle due to a minor technical difficulty. Mm-hmm. So at this point, nobody on the airplane knew what was going on.
It actually doesn't sound like literally the whole time none of the passengers knew what was going on. Like, no. They got off, like, clueless.
Yeah, they didn't know until people started, like, interviewing them.
Yeah, which is crazy.
So yeah, like you said, Northwest Orient Airlines agreed to the demands, and the flight remained in air circling Seattle for 2 hours in order to give the FBI time to gather the money.
In addition to the money, he also asked for 2 sets of parachutes.
Part of the reason I think that they complied is because they kind of thought that he was asking for 2 sets of parachutes because he was going to take a hostage with him,
mm-hmm.
which kind of ensured that they couldn't mess with the parachutes because mm-hmm. they could put someone's life in danger. So it was basically his way of ensuring that they didn't, you know, tamper with them so that they would still open while he was flying through the air.
Also, when he asked for the $200,000, he specified that it needed to be in 20s with the random serial numbers.
Yes. And he asked for it specifically to be an American currency, which is interesting.
Yes.
Yes.
I also heard that detail, the FBI, or maybe not, someone official is not positive whether the pilot added American currency or whether Dan himself said American currency.
I feel like it's a weird detail for either of them to say, but especially the pilot, because, like, why wouldn't it be American currency?
That's true.
They're in America.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So it's a weird detail.
Definitely.
I'm not positive on this one, but it's reported that on the parachutes, he also specified for them to be civilian parachutes and not military parachutes. Right. And there is a difference. Apparently, I'm not sure why this makes sense, but military parachutes are like more dome-like and you can't steer them. They're more so made, from my understanding, to be like a discreet thing to just transport a human from the air to the ground. Whereas civilian parachutes, you can steer and they're more of like a glider shape as opposed to a dome. And they had like an easy pull system, which was different than military parachutes, perhaps. In the end, though, I don't believe that he got what he was asking for with these parachutes.
No, I don't believe at least that they were steerable.
No. It's actually so odd, which maybe we'll like get into it when we get there. But like, it's odd. What happened?
It is odd what happened. That's why we're talking about this. You're right. That is a clip right there. Thank you. So flight attendant Tina Mucklow sat with Cooper during this time and later remarked on his demeanor that he seemed nice, not nervous at all, and familiar with the local area as he kept pointing out landmarks. Specifically, he pointed out, I think it was a military base. He was like, oh, we must not be far from Seattle Airport because this is close by.
Interesting. So
it's an interesting thing for him to point out because, like, how would you know how close the base is to the airport?
Yeah, your average civilian would not know that.
No. Especially from the sky, right? Mm. Like, how
no kidding.
Would you know? In fact, Tina felt at ease enough to ask him why he was doing this, to which he responded that he had no grudge against the airline. It was just because he had a grudge.
Interesting. What does it mean?
What does it mean? Making polite conversation, he even asked her where she was from and remarked how nice her home state of Minnesota was. But when she asked where he was from, he became visibly upset and wouldn't answer.
Oh no.
He then changed the subject by offering her a cigarette, which she accepted even though she had quit smoking. I can't blame her though. Could you
honestly
imagine?
Need something.
Yeah.
I also heard that, so during the time that they were talking, he kept one hand on either the briefcase or the trigger point of the bomb. So while he was smoking, she had to light his cigarette for him because he would not move his hand.
Right. Mm-hmm. At around 5:45, the flight landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. Tina exited the plane through the front and returned with the ransom, and only then did Cooper agree to let the passengers go. As he counted the money, Tina jokingly asked for some, which he promptly obliged. And she didn't accept it, as tips were against company policy.
Oh my gosh, that is ridiculous.
This is not the first time that he offered anyone money. He offered, I think, all the flight attendants at some point money, and they all turned it down.
I've not heard that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. What is his deal? I don't get it. He also, at some point, possibly ordered another bourbon and paid for it in cash. Also, like, on the flight, after they'd found out about the bomb.
Yes.
He ordered another one and was like, oh, thank you. I will pay you. And even though I'm threatening to blow you up, here's some money. I'm a good person.
He has a very interesting moral code. I think that he didn't finish this one. I think he might have spilled it and not asked for another one.
Oh.
Which is interesting, because it just tells you something about who he is. He doesn't need it. He just wanted it. He did let flight attendants Alice Hancock and Florence Schaffner go, but requested that Tina Mucklow stay behind. So when Tina asked if Cooper would be needing instructions for the parachutes, he declined, as if he already knew how to use them.
I did hear that, so after they did the exchange with the people for the things, that they had they hadn't realized that they'd brought the wrong parachutes or something like that, as in they'd brought military parachutes when he'd asked for civilian, and he made them go and get him some civilian parachutes, which caused a little bit of an extra delay. And he also demanded that they refuel. He demanded, so like when they were up in the air, he also was like, have a fueling truck ready.
So Cooper did cut open one of the bags to use it as to carry for carrying the money. Because I think he requested a knapsack and they didn't give him one. So he just cut it open and used one of them to carry the money. So
casual.
And an interesting fact to consider is that all the bills were in $20 denominations. Mm-hmm. Which is heavier than $100, right? Because more bills.
Mm-hmm.
So that would also affect how big the bag needed to be and how much he weighed jumping out of the airplane. I don't know how much exactly it would weigh.
I think it's something like 21 pounds.
Okay, so not like a small...
No, it's like enough to make a noticeable difference.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, enough to be kind of cumbersome.
It makes sense with the why he asked for it, because $100 bills would have been suspicious.
Yeah, especially in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
$20 bills were more passable.
Yeah. So since he did cut open the one bag to carry the money, he must have assumed that the other ones were going to be totally fine. And at this point, like you said, the plane was being refueled, but Cooper was starting to get a bit antsy.
So Mr. Cooper
mm-hmm.
had enough knowledge of the whole situation at this time that he knew about how long the refueling should take. This plane refueled at about 4,000 gallons per minute or something like that, and it should have been done in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, so he was familiar. I don't know how long it would take to fill up an airplane. I would assume it would take hours because it's so big.
Right?
So, like, he knew that.
Mm-hmm. And because they were taking so long, he apparently was getting, like you said, he was getting a little bit antsier. Answer to the point that, so normally when pilots take off, they have to submit an in-flight, or no, a flight plan, which is just something to somewhere that tells them where we're going. Mr. Cooper was like, this is taking up too much time. We are not submitting that. Just fly in this general direction and fly to Mexico City in some variation of that. With the cabin lights off, flaps at 15 degrees, and the air stairs down. And the captain was like, no.
That's one, so unsafe.
One, we don't have the capacity to reach Mexico City. We would need to refuel somewhere. And two, we cannot take off with the air stairs down. They then decided on a refueling stop in either, I believe, or from what information I saw, Cooper suggested either Phoenix, Yuma, or Sacramento. And somehow they agreed on Reno.
The flight took to the air again around 7:40 p.m., with only the remaining crew on board with Cooper. Cooper had also requested that the flight go as slow as possible, as low as possible.
So, I heard that he had specific, like, numbers.
Yes!
He requested them stay under 10,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
which is actually a normal skydiving range.
Yes!
And go, and stay below 150 knots, which... So, normal skydiving for civilians is at, like, 90 knots.
Mm-hmm.
But, trained professionals are trained, military professionals skydive at around like 120 to 130.
Wow.
So it's feasible that he could skydive at this.
Mm-hmm.
Possible.
Mm-hmm. This is also like the slowest that the plane could possibly do.
Yeah, without like plummeting out of the sky. Because of the air. It's like the air is denser when you're lower. So you need to go faster, or you need to stay at a certain speed in order to push enough dense
so
air
smart.
To get
crazy.
Somewhere.
Okay.
This is the plane crash documentaries.
So they were flying southeast towards Mexico City, and unbeknownst to them, they were followed by three jets.
Dun dun.
Dun dun dun. This is like more of a dun 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 moment than it actually is, because mm-hmm. they actually couldn't see anything happening, because it was a dark and stormy-ish night. It was rainy and cold, but not freezing.
There are also fighter jets.
Yeah, like, they could have shot it down at any moment.
Yeah. They're, like, legit, like, fancy jets.
Yeah.
I'm sure they had night vision on them, just because. I mean, I'm sure they had all sorts of vision on them, just because. I can't imagine that they didn't.
Yeah, whatever happened in the 70s.
And somehow, they all failed. Did you hear about the red vision thing? I just saw this, and I don't know if it's real or not, but I saw it on YouTube Shorts. It was, like, at some point in the Vietnam War, which I think was around this time, instead of night vision, they had something called red vision goggles, which people were, like, soldiers were losing their minds and, like, saying, I'm seeing, like, the devil or, like, devilish things, and, like, really scary stuff was happening. So they eventually took that out of circulation and was like, we're not using that. And eventually it came to light that the people that, like, saw things were not going crazy because there was a chemical in these goggles that was leaking and making them hallucinate.
Ew.
So, like, there's some really bad things that happened. I mean, they're supposed to be stealthy, and someone just, like, loses their mind and, like, starts shooting or, like, screaming because they see something. They're seeing something, but there's nothing there.
That's so scary. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
We should do a whole podcast about that. So after takeoff is when he finally put on his famous D.B. Cooper dark sunglasses.
Wow.
He was finally ready to hide his identity. after being seen by 42 passengers.
That is really a good call.
So at this point, after takeoff, he asked Tina to lower the staircase, but she was scared that she'd be sucked out of the plane if she did so. And he was not concerned about this. He knew that was not about to happen, as the plane was flying low enough that there wouldn't be much change in pressure, especially because he had asked the cabin to remain unpressurized.
Because the captain was like, no, we will not take off with the air stairs down. He was like, okay, well then in that case, I would like someone to show me how to use, how to lower the air stairs while we're in flight. And then I have that this person, which was Tina, that she showed him, and then he ordered her to go back to the cabin.
So yeah, Cooper ordered her to go to the cockpit, assuring her that he'd either take the bomb or disarm it. She asked him to. She was like, please don't leave this on board.
Reasonable.
And she was the last person to see D.B. Cooper and left him tying something to his waist, assuming the parachute bag that he had filled with the money.
Okay, so after Tina went to the cockpit, she was told not to emerge until after the flight or something like that. So she went to the cockpit and locked the door. And they all just sort of waited. They had talked to him about something via the phone line at around 8:05, which was their last communication with him. And then they felt the plane do a little something in which they assumed was the air stair opening about 10 minutes later. Okay. And then I have that they did not go back out to check until they landed. I think that part's corroborated with the FBI transcripts, because there's during one of their conversations, the captain or the pilot mentioned that they were trying to get a hold of the back to see if they could close the door, meaning they were ringing the phone back there to see. I don't know. I mean, it's not like he would tell them that just go right ahead. I don't know what they were doing, but... And when they were getting closer to landing, that's when they had this conversation with air traffic control or someone like that.
Okay.
They were like, yeah, we can't get a hold of the back. And they mentioned something along the lines of, we can't get a hold of the back, and we don't want to close the door just in case he's there, or something like that.
Gets angry and blows up the plane.
Yeah. This was a little bit later when they were preparing to land. They had mentioned, we can't seem to raise the back there. If he is there, we kind of hate to. We just as soon land with a thing hanging down.
Yeah.
Probably, like you said, because if they did close it, or try to close it, and he was there, he would blow up the plane.
Yeah, he'd get mad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is possible to land with it open, which they did do.
They did, and they did successfully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also interesting, because of, like, the air stairs don't, like, fully come down. They only go down, like, a couple inches or something like that. So, like, they wouldn't have opened enough for Cooper to just, like, he couldn't have even, like, squeezed out of it, if that makes sense.
Really?
If he wasn't putting his weight on it. So because he put his weight on it, that was enough to lower the stairs.
Okay.
But if there was no weight on them, they just maybe barely open enough for him to squeeze out with a parachute.
Interesting.
So like they're it's not like it's hanging like fully open.
Right.
Certainly is when they get further into landing.
Yeah.
But
cuz I had that they saw that the stairs had opened and then they felt the dip up like 15 minutes later. And I was so confused, and I heard lots of people being confused as to why him jumping out of the airplane would have caused such a change, like this, like, 150-pound man, you know?
It's because the pressure of him opened the staircase.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And crazy. So there's animations of him just sort of walking down and then going, wee! But in theory...
Wee!
Well, literally, he is. In theory... It would have made more sense if he actually walked backwards down the stairs and then just sort of...
Ew, fell back.
Yeah.
Ooh, gross. Scary.
Because otherwise there might have been too much force and it just would have made more sense, theoretically, for him to be walking backwards.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, like you said, the crew remained in the cockpit until they landed, upon which the plane was searched and no sign of the hijacker was found, except for some evidence, and we will talk about that coming right up. Shall we talk about the investigation?
Oh, sure.
So, I do want to say at this point that there was a typo in a news story, which is why we have D.B. Cooper and not Dan Cooper. Mm-hmm. Throughout all of this, he was going by Dan Cooper. That's how he, like, signed up for his plane ticket. That's what he, like, introduced himself to the flight attendants as, Dan Cooper, not D.B. Cooper. So somewhere along the lines, things got mixed up, and now he's known as D.B. Cooper.
There was actually a D.B. Cooper suspect, which some people are kind of wondering, is that where the confusion came from? Like, the news people just accidentally took D.B. Cooper instead of Dan Cooper, because that's the name that they were talking about that day, and were like, oh, obviously, this is the guy. Like, this is the guy's name, not this is the actual, this is a human being that's a suspect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That could have been how it got confused, but genuinely no one knows. Apparently not even the FBI.
But it's so stuck. Interesting.
Yes.
Like, he used a fake name, and then it got even faker, and he probably was like, what a win.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Got an extra letter.
They won't find me now. Spoiler alert, they don't. Crazy.
Oh my gosh.
This hijacking became known as NORJAC, Northwest Hijacking.
Yes.
Yes. So when I say NORJAC, from here on out, that's what I'm referring to. So during the ensuing investigation, the plane was searched for evidence. They found Cooper's black clip-on tie with a small little hair of DNA.
Which is also so funny that it was, like, a clip-on and not, like, a real tie.
It's kind of iconic. They also found a tie clip, cigarette butts, which later went missing.
I have thoughts on that.
And two of the parachutes that were still left on the plane. He only took two parachutes, one of which he tied around his waist and left the other two.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, possibly, this is possible information, it's not confirmed, he might have actually taken one of the military parachutes.
Right, because they sourced the parachutes from different places. They weren't all from the same place.
Yes. And I believe it was a civilian training facility, like civilian skydiving training facility that was nearby that they took the civilian chutes from. And I think it's that chute that he took, one of those chutes from them, that actually was a fake chute. It was just a dummy chute. Like, it did not open. And also, someone had said, which I found really interesting, so there's like a main parachute and then a reserved parachute. And he took the two, like, typically reserved parachutes. Like, the two last resort parachutes instead of either the two main parachutes or one main and one reserved. Which was a choice.
A choice.
He took the two, like, ones that you don't necessarily want to have to use.
Yes. So this kind of leads investigators to almost believe that maybe he wasn't very experienced.
Right, which is so strange, because up until this moment, up until the parachute moment that he picked the parachutes, it all seems, like, so well thought out and, like, perfectly executed.
Yeah.
Like, literally perfectly executed. And then this was, like, the one moment that was like, oh, why would he do that?
Yeah. He was so meticulous about, like, certain things. And then other things he seemed to sort of overlook, like the sunglasses that he didn't put on until halfway through.
Yes, that's actually a really good point. I didn't think about that one.
He was meticulous enough to request that he was able to take the notes that he had handed to the flight attendants. Mm-hmm. He didn't leave those behind. He took them with him.
Mm-hmm.
So as not to leave evidence. But then he left the cigarette butts, which contained DNA, which of course wasn't really a thing in the 70s, but still.
True.
As well as he left his clip-on tie. Like, he just left that there. So it's like,
I mean,
how is he so meticulous about some things and so not about other things?
That's fair.
And about the parachutes, I almost wonder if he requested civilian parachutes because he thought that would be easier to source. But maybe he could have gone either way. He could have been just as fine with a military one. But that doesn't explain why he took a dummy chute.
I don't think he knew that it was a dummy chute.
Yeah.
Because also, let's be real here. The man jumped, or, like, exited an air stair on a plane.
At night, in the rain.
Yeah, and with cloud cover, like, it's theorized that he couldn't see very much. So I would kind of assume that at this point, he's kind of, I mean, his mind has got to be, like, elsewhere. Or, like, going, like, really fast, right? And right before Tina left him in the plane, when she had asked him to please, like, take the bomb, he didn't really respond. Like, he didn't even act like he heard what she said. And she just kind of walked away. So that kind of makes me believe that maybe he was maybe, like, a little bit, like,
freaking out.
Yeah, like his brain just could not pick up on the idea that this was a dummy shoot. Also, why would he assume? Like, I don't even... If the purpose that he picked, like, asked for four parachutes, two sets of parachutes, was to, make the investigators think, or the FBI, or whoever, make the authoritative people think that he was taking a hostage, he would really have any reason to believe that they would give him, like, any sort of affected parachute.
Yeah, they claimed it was by mistake.
Of course.
They gathered eyewitness testimony and a composite sketch was made.
I'm pretty sure Tina was, like, integral in this part of this process because she'd spent the most time with him.
Yeah.
She looked at his face the most.
Yes. There were three official sketches of Cooper done, the last one being the closest likeness according to Tina and Florence Schaffner. He was described as around 5'10", 175-ish pounds, mid-40s, short black hair, and olive skin.
Someone described him also as, not anyone that was involved in the situation, but like a third party, described him as someone that you probably wouldn't pay too much attention to if you saw in passing.
Yeah.
Which is fair.
Yeah, he just looks like an average guy. And he was like, average height, average build.
Average.
He was just like, if somebody was going to get away with something like this, it was going to be this guy. You know?
Just has that face.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned before, there were fighter jets following. They didn't see him.
They didn't see anything. They didn't actually see him jump out. They didn't see anything.
No.
Because it was a dark and stormy-ish night.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, like, crazy stormy, but it was, like, rainy.
Yeah.
It's said that, like, any experienced parachutist wouldn't have done this. It leads the FBI to wonder, and investigators to wonder, whether he did it for the money or if he did it for the thrill. And I kind of wonder that too, because he wasn't seemingly too concerned about the money. He tried to give it away. He like strapped it with a parachute. He didn't like force the knapsack issue. Like, it's just weird. He seemed a little bit careless with the money. $200,000 is a lot of money, especially back then, but he could have asked for more.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like almost a weirdly specific number.
Agreed.
And a weirdly low number. Like, to have, for me specifically, to have to live the rest of my life in fear, I don't know that much money would be enough.
That's a good point. I'm actually going to Google how much it would be today.
$1.5 million.
Oh, you've already Googled it. I mean, 1.5 is like...
It's a lot of money. It's a good amount of money. But he's not going to... I mean, he must have known that he's not going to be able to spend it, theoretically.
That's true.
Because they would have, you know, noted down the numbers of the bills and stuff. And there are ways that can slip through the cracks, but still.
And they did. They categorically, I believe, photographed every single bill that they gave him. And they also made sure that all the bills started with the letter L.
Yeah. I've heard conflicting reports as to whether or not they think that Cooper was skilled, like a skilled parachutist, or whether he was military, or whether he was just some guy. Like, there seems to be a lot of conflicting things about that because of the mistakes that he made, but also the weird amount of knowledge that he had about these things. And it was 1971. You can't Google things like that, you know?
Yes, that's what I was thinking too. Like, he had to have known someone or had known himself.
Yeah.
Like, experienced himself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? He either had to know someone experienced or had the experience himself.
Yeah, exactly. Also, because of the fact that he was seeming to be in his 40s, he was kind of out of the range of the average civilian parachutist or skydiver as a hobby.
Oh.
He was a little older than that.
That's fair.
Hobby. Not that he couldn't have done it, you know?
No, but average age.
Like, my mom's in her 50s and she still did judo and, like, stuff like that. She would probably jump out of an airplane now. I love her.
Oh, she's so cool.
Hi, Mom.
Hi.
It's also interesting to note how intelligent he was. Like, his demeanor with people was not that of somebody who was rough around the edges, you know?
He was polished.
He was so polished.
Calm, he was polished, and it was also said that he used intelligent words, not just common speech.
And he is on an airplane.
That's true.
That's fancy. So this intelligence may have made it that he would not have wanted an accomplice or needed one. And it's also interesting because when they changed his flight path, he didn't have a specific flight path in mind. He just said, fly southeast towards Mexico City, and didn't seem to, like, Like, if he had an accomplice on the ground, is what I'm saying, they would have needed to have a meetup point, and it didn't seem like that was a concern for him.
And they didn't have cell phones. There would have been no easy way for him to get in touch with said accomplice. Once he'd landed wherever, he'd have to walk somewhere far to get to a payphone.
Yes, and I have a theory about that. Mm. Because Tina said that what was in the briefcase looked like dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is maybe there was flares. They were flares, not dynamite.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yes, because I will say at this point also, the FBI believes that... Oops. The FBI believes that the bomb was not real.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another theory I'd heard about that is it's quarters. It's a roll of quarters and red duct tape.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't hear about that, but that's bold.
Yep. Specifically so that when he got to the ground, he could go to a payphone and use the quarters to pay, or yeah, to call his accomplice or someone to come and get him.
Interesting.
I don't know that I necessarily believe that, but it's a theory.
His choice of the Boeing 727 was an interesting one, as it was unique in that the stairs could be opened mid-flight. That's interesting. So he must have known something about the plane in order to have chosen the specific plane, or he just got lucky, but...
I feel like it's unlucky. Or unlikely. Whoa. It's unlikely that he just got lucky.
Yeah, because it's like, I would not think, and I would hope, that the flight could not, or the stairs could not be lowered mid-flight.
That's terrifying to just be a passenger going, oh, I wonder if these stairs could just be lowered right now. Also, I'm not sure if you've heard this, but secretly, around the same time, the CIA was actually using this plane to covertly drop... agents in the Vietnam War.
Wow.
It was a secret. Very few people apparently knew about.
That's interesting. So that leads more credence to the idea that he could have been part of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And also because he knew where the military base was.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
I know.
I will say D.B. Cooper was not wearing any sort of survival gear that they could tell. He was wearing a business suit.
Yes. And it was like November.
Yeah.
At this time. So yes. It was not summer.
No, it was cold.
He was also just wearing, like, regular... I think they called them loafers.
Yeah.
Like, regular shoes.
Yeah.
Not trekking anything. Nothing about him was saying, I'm going to trek in the wilderness.
Exactly. And the bag that he carried, obviously there was nothing in the briefcase, but he did have the paper bag, which maybe nobody knows what was in it, so it could have maybe carried some survival gear. Like, jumping out of an airplane, you're gonna need some goggles, you know? Or, like, gloves, maybe some boots or a helmet.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you're gonna need some things jumping out of an airplane that he didn't have, which is interesting. So maybe that was in the paper bag, because we don't know what was in the paper bag.
I would hope that's what's in the paper bag. Originally, I just assumed it was alcohol for some reason.
Interesting.
I don't know why.
I mean, that makes sense.
I feel like that's just what I would expect normally.
In a paper bag?
Yeah.
It's either a child's lunch or a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah. Yeah. So he would have, like, feasibly stuffed... No, he would have used the items in the paper bag. Whatever he didn't use, he would have stuffed it along with the money, probably.
Yeah, or just tossed it out of an airplane.
Well, how would he have found it after?
You're right. How would he have? Unless he, like, just held it and jumped out of an airplane. But I don't think you can really do that.
Well, see, that was another thing. So, feasibly, he couldn't have just held on to the money. Because it was heavy enough and big enough that he just could not have held on to it by himself. So that's why he had most likely strapped it on himself.
Yeah. So, like, we don't... It infuriates me that we don't know what was in this paper bag. And I want to know. And I assume it must have been some sort of survival gear. But I don't
know. Must have been.
It must have been.
Yeah.
Unless it was a real bomb. Let's talk about the actual investigation. After they searched the plane, what happened? They couldn't really narrow down too much where he could have landed, as they don't know exactly when he jumped, and the jets behind, like we said, couldn't see him. And any number of things could have gone wrong, like injury upon landing, exposure to the elements, or even him just getting lost in the wilderness. Although it wasn't freezing, it would have been uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The FBI even retraced the flight path in an attempt to find any sign of him, with no avail, no luck.
Shoot, that's shocking.
And the most they could narrow it down was an area around the south of Mount St. Helens in Washington, near the Washougal River. And it's interesting, because when I thought before of D.B. Cooper jumping out of an airplane, I thought he lands in the middle of the wilderness, in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he could have landed just as easily if he landed in this area, he could have landed just as easily in someone's backyard.
That is crazy.
Isn't that insane? So it's like he maybe didn't need to have survival gear because he could have just like walked to a road and hitchhiked a ride.
Yeah.
But he couldn't have known that because he wouldn't have been able to see the ground from the sky.
And he also didn't know where they were.
Yeah.
Like, precisely.
Yeah.
They weren't going off of a predetermined plan. They were just kind of going.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy, though.
So, the area was searched extensively by land and helicopter, even checking the lakes and rivers nearby, but no sign of Cooper or the money or supposed bomb was found. And it's interesting that it was in the Mount St. Helens area, because when it erupted, it could have possibly buried some of the evidence. So the investigation was suspended in July of 2016, and Norjak remains the only unsolved case of commercial airline piracy. So the evidence that they collected from the plane was inspected, the clip-on tie, the tie clip, the cigarette butts. And the cigarette butts did eventually go missing, so we don't really have a lot of DNA. The only real piece of DNA that we have is the tiny particles of hair that was on the tie.
Yeah.
Which might not even be his.
That's very disappointing.
It's very disappointing. So we don't know whether this hair is his, so it's not even, like, conclusive that we could test this for DNA and trace back, like they've done for certain cases nowadays. But they did also find unalloyed titanium on this tie.
Yes.
Yes. Unalloyed?
I think so.
Unalloyed titanium.
Yeah.
Yeah. This unalloyed titanium is rare. It was not really used on a lot of things, but it was used in Boeing manufacturers, and it is an essential part of the operations that isn't commonly used in other industries, except for, like, Boeings and railways.
Yes!
Which we'll talk about. So because Cooper was so knowledgeable about this specific airplane, it's possible that he could have worked for Boeing or been a pilot himself, because he did know so much about that specifically.
I mean, how would you know about airspeeds and not, like, yeah, no, airspeeds and height without specific knowledge?
Yeah. I mean, like, nowadays you can find almost anything on the internet.
Well, that's true.
But, like, back then you couldn't.
No.
Back then you had to, like, know people or just know things.
Yeah.
In February 1980, 8-year-old Brian Ingram found a bundle of cash equaling around $5,800.
He found it in 3 separate bags, I believe.
But it was still in, like, the bundle. It still had, like, the rubber band around it.
So it was in 3 bundles in one bag. Am I understanding?
I'm not sure, but I know it did have the rubber attached to it, I think. Okay. I know, I think.
Okay.
So the money washed ashore the Columbia River about 9 miles or 14 kilometers downstream from Vancouver, Washington. And the bills were borderline disintegrated, but the FBI was able to confirm that this was indeed part of the ransom money. And they were able to determine through the state of the paper and the rubber bands that still surrounded it, that the money would have had to enter the water months after the hijacking took place. I think due to the algae in the water, there's, like, algae blooms around spring. And this, like, these bills had the algae bloom on it, which they would have only been able to have after the hijacking.
Interesting.
Because they wouldn't have been able to be in the water for that long without being disintegrated. So they must have entered sometime in the spring, not in fall, like right after the hijacking.
I think there was also, they'd done some like moving of sand and stuff into, I want to say, I can't Google it now because nothing's coming up, obviously. That's just always how it happens. I think the area was called like Tina Bay.
Tina Bar?
Yes, thank you, Tina Bar. So this, they'd move sand from elsewhere to this bar at some point in the past few years. I believe the way that they found it, it was determined that it wasn't likely that it came from the sand elsewhere. And it was, like you said, along with the sediments that were found on it, they would have had to have been placed there, not moved there, based on what all of that stuff. It's very technical.
That's so weird. Like, why, if he had jumped out of the airplane and some of the money got ripped away from him, how would it have landed there, like, 9 years later?
Yeah. Have you looked at the flight path?
Like,
because it's pretty far. it's not likely that the money would have just blown out of the plane when he jumped or traveled downstream from where he approximately landed, because the stream actually went the opposite direction. Right. So, like, it couldn't have just traveled there on its own. It leads to the idea that it was specifically placed there for some reason.
Right.
Also, did we mention that these bills matched bills that were given to Cooper? Like, these are confirmed bills.
Yeah. The FBI did confirm that they were the actual part of the ransom. And this is, like, there's no, we don't know where the rest of the money is still. Mm-mm. Or how or why it was separated. And to this day, the rest of it has not been found.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they did, they, like, used submarines and radar to search that river and maybe dredged it also.
Yeah.
Like, they did search for it in that spot and they didn't come up with anything else.
It's so weird. And it was shallow enough that, like, this kid playing in the sand found it.
I thought he was digging something. He was, like, digging.
But he wasn't, like, digging, like, a grave. He was just digging in the sand to, like, make a sandcastle.
I thought he was digging for, like, a shelter or, like, something. He's 8, isn't he?
He's 8.
He wouldn't be digging for a shelter. That's dumb.
Maybe, but there's only so much an 8-year-old can do, right?
That's fair. He's kind of limited.
Yeah. He did end up selling the bills at auction and making, like, a ton of money from it.
Oh, so good for him. Oh, yeah. Wait, the FBI didn't, like, take it back?
They took some of it and let him keep the rest.
Aw.
Yeah.
That's sweet, actually.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. I wonder where the money is now. Like, who bought it? I wonder. Reach out. Let us know. WeirdThingsAndWine@gmail.com.
If you're a collector,
I'd love to hear from you.
Honestly. In 2008... 15 of the $20 bills sold for more than $37,000.
He made bank. Good for him. Oh my
gosh. I don't know if this is from him, because this was 2008. Oh. But.
Never mind. The FBI did publicly state that Cooper had probably died during doing this. Like, he had jumped out of an airplane, fallen, died. But no body was ever found. Mm. Which is interesting.
One of the lead investigators at some point did put his, like, favor towards the idea that he's still alive. Yeah. Just because after so many years, they found nothing.
Yes.
Except for the money, which shows that someone put it there.
It is speculated that perhaps the FBI only claimed that they believed that he had died so as to discourage future hijackings. But they actually do believe that he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
If he was still alive, though, he would be, like, well into his 90s now.
Yeah.
So he's probably, if he was alive, he probably isn't anymore.
No. I mean, I hope he lived a good life after this. He didn't hurt anyone, technically.
No.
It was not a great choice.
No.
Do not do this, ever.
Don't.
Anyone. But.
He won't get away with it now, I promise you.
That's very true.
He couldn't even get on a plane with, like, a little bit of water, honestly. So, there have been countless suspects, but none are particularly of interest. Like, there has been so many, and there's so many, because of the infamous nature of this case, there have been a ton of people claiming on their deathbed to be D.B. Cooper.
Yes.
And a ton of people saying, oh, I think my brother, or my uncle, or my husband is D.B. Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were also a couple people back when this happened, shortly after, who sold stories to the tabloids that they themselves were D.B. Cooper.
Right.
They were arrested.
Yeah, don't claim to be a criminal.
They didn't get away with it.
While hijackings weren't really such a thing before this, there were 15 similar ones in the year following D.B. Cooper. But none were successful and all were caught.
Mm-hmm.
So going into the suspects, I have a few that I would like to talk about because I think they are the most interesting and most credible, as well as I searched through the Reddit to see what the general consensus of was.
Smart.
Of people who, like, are more into this case than I could possibly be, ever.
It would take, like, genuinely, like, years to know all of the information.
Yes.
There's so much.
People devote, like, their lives to this.
Mm-hmm.
We only had, like, a month to research. We don't know how Cooper got to the airport. His car has not been found. We don't know, like, if somebody dropped him off, or if he walked, if he took, like, a public bus system. Nobody knows.
There also have been no missing persons reports of anyone matching his description.
Right. So it's like, maybe he did survive. Because nobody, like, reported him missing.
It's like he either survived or, like,
and did anyone that would have known him. Or, like, cared that he wasn't there.
Oh, goodness.
But it doesn't feel like he has the demeanor to do that.
Doesn't strike me as that kind of person. But also, he could have just been from a different state. We don't know. Like,
oh, that's true. Oh, that's... Maybe, ooh.
Yeah. Mm. Maybe he flew in from Texas and then boarded a plane.
Or, like, Canada.
Yes. I have opinions about that one. So let's talk about a similar hijacking to D.B. Cooper.
Very similar,
which was conducted by a man named Richard McCoy. On April 7th of 1971, so just a few months after Cooper, he boarded a Boeing 727 headed to Los Angeles, California from Newark, New Jersey, going by the alias James Johnson.
Not as cool.
No. So he was armed with a pistol and a hand grenade and demanded $500,000.
Brazen.
Very brazen. You're right. In the middle of the flight, he did the same thing that Cooper did and jumped from the stairs in the back. I believe that he was caught 2 days later following a tip from a man who had actually given him a ride right after and noticed a jumpsuit and duffel bag.
Wow. Casual.
He protested innocence, but the FBI found the money and the jumpsuit in his house.
I'm pretty sure he also left, like, copious amounts of evidence on the plane. His fingerprints were everywhere. He left the notes, because he had also given notes, more than one note, I believe, to the flight attendants, and he left them with the flight attendants.
Yeah, and he was nervous, visibly nervous.
Yes. I heard that he started off calm and collected, similar to Cooper, and then shortly afterwards got visibly nervous and started, like, making mistakes.
Right. I don't think he was very old either at
the
time.
He was, like, 28?
Yeah.
I think.
So he was quite a bit younger than Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sentenced to 45 years, but escaped prison shortly after by stealing a garbage truck with a couple of other prisoners.
Wild.
And the others were caught just a few days later, but McCoy made it a whole 3 months before he was found and eventually killed in a shootout with authorities. So Richard McCoy could be D.B. Cooper, but there's a few reasons as to why it's almost definitely not him.
Mm.
Specifically, you know, he was nervous, he made a lot more mistakes, he was quite a bit younger than Cooper. He also didn't look like him, he also spoke with a southern accent and was not polished like D.B. Cooper was.
Ah.
But still, he has not been entirely ruled out as a suspect.
I'm pretty sure one of the policeman that shot him or one of the policemen involved said something along the lines of, when I killed him, I killed Cooper.
Yes.
Which is quite a statement.
It's bold.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether he said that metaphorically, like he killed him and in his mind he was also putting away the D.B. Cooper case. I don't understand it, but
there's a lot of levels.
I disagree that he was D.B. Cooper. I don't think any of these suspects are D.B. Cooper, for the record.
Hmm.
The next one I will talk about is William J. Smith. So he was named as a suspect in 2018. He would have been 43 at the time of the hijacking, so in the right age range. And he did have a motive, as he had recently lost his pension because the railroad he worked at had gone bankrupt. The unalloyed titanium that they found on the tie could have come from a railroad, which also leads further credence to the idea that he could have been D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a veteran, so he would have had knowledge of parachutes and stuff, and he looked a ton like Cooper.
There's one specific drawing that they did of him, of Cooper, aged.
Mm-hmm.
And at that age, Smith looks very similar to the drawing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's is why I have him written down. If you Google this guy, he looks exactly like him.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncanny. He also had a friend named Daniel Cooper who had passed during the war, so this could be where the alias came from. I was mostly interested in him as a suspect because he looks so much like Cooper.
Yeah.
It's, like, really weird. Google it, I swear. One of the other suspects is a man named Robert Rackstraw. And this guy is the focus of the documentary that was on Netflix. A man named Tom Colbert, I believe is how you say his name, really is the one who is, like, leading the charge that this man specifically is D.B. Cooper.
Did he write a book?
I believe so.
Okay.
I disagree. I don't think he's D.B. Cooper.
I did watch the documentary.
Robert Rackstraw was only 28 at the time of the hijacking, so quite a bit younger. But also, it was 1971. Everybody drank and smoked back then. You were going to look little older than you actually were. And he does look quite a bit like Cooper, but I don't know that he looks enough like Cooper.
Okay.
Robert Rackstraw also served on an Army helicopter crew during the Vietnam War, so he would have known how to use a parachute. So, Robert Rackstraw was a bit of a shady guy. He was arrested for possession of explosives and check fraud.
Yikes.
So, he does have a criminal background. He did make bail and then attempted to fake his own death by radioing air traffic control and telling them that he was jumping out of a rented airplane. So, then he was arrested again for forging pilot credentials.
Wow. Going well.
Going so well. He also did at some point claim that he was D.B. Cooper. Or not claim. So there's like videos of him as a young man. And he's like, I mean, I might have been D.B. Cooper. Who's to say I wasn't? He did say things like that and then got a lot of media attention. And he was in the documentary, not as like a talking head, but more as a... They were following him around with cameras and trying to get him to talk to him.
Interesting.
It was a choice. It was a choice.
That doesn't seem very... That doesn't seem beneficial.
No. So, he could be D.B. Cooper, but I'm going to say he's not. Moving on. The newest suspect is Vincent Peterson. And a man named Eric Ulis has been investigating this case for over a decade. He's the one who named this guy as a suspect.
Okay.
So while Peterson has passed away, he would have been 52 at the time of the hijacking. So a little bit older, but...
In the range.
In the range. And he was an engineer at a titanium plant that was a subcontractor for Boeing.
Oh!
The titanium particles on the tie match up with the exact blend that was used at this specific plant that Peterson worked at.
Wow.
And the supervisor at the plant did say that Peterson matched the description and that he would occasionally travel with him to Seattle for work. So he not only would have been familiar with Boeing, he would have been familiar with this flight path.
Wow. That's a little suspicious.
It's a little suspicious. So that's the newest suspect.
Okay. Wow.
So, now we are on to my last suspect. This idea was told to me by someone that I know who's pretty sure that this guy is D.B. Cooper. And he knows the case because he lived in the town that this guy was from. My inside scoop, if you will call him, he watched... I think it was like an Unsolved Mystery or something like that. One of those popular shows where they talk about mysteries.
Yeah.
And this man was talked about. Not as a D.B. Cooper suspect, but for a different reason, which I will tell you about right now.
Okay.
So there was a guy who lived in Cranbrook, which is a B.C. town that is right across the border from Washington. Now this man was named Alex Cooper, and he looks a ton like the sketch.
Interesting. I have not seen this.
The thing is, Alex Cooper vanished in 1987. He was last seen paying for his lunch with a wad of cash.
Oh.
And when his wife tried to find his birth certificate to give to the authorities, she discovered that Alex Cooper didn't legally exist until their marriage in 1952. And then, in 1991, a man named David Cooper was reported missing in Toronto. The police found photos of Alex/David, and they connected the dots. Apparently, he had tried to return home, and his landlady told him about the police, so he vanished again before they tracked him down in 1992.
Okay, wait, so he was Alex. Alex and David are the same person.
Alex and David are the same person.
Oh, no! Oh, my goodness.
So he disappeared again and showed up in 1992. They question him, the authorities question him, like, why do you keep disappearing? Like, are you on the run? Because we don't know what crime we could get you for. And he admitted that his name was actually Albin Arsene Arsenault, which is a name.
Wow, that is a name.
And in his youth, he was falsely accused of robbing an office in the Union Pacific Railroad and went on the run to avoid being punished for a crime that he didn't do.
Wow. Also falsely? Are we sure?
I mean, he went on the run twice. So he changed his name and got married, but he had to submit his birth certificate to receive his pension. He obviously didn't have one, so he decided to vanish.
Oh.
As you do.
Of course.
So he was reunited with his family after he was found and lived until 2007. And he is a suspect of the D.B. Cooper case because of his penchant for just disappearing randomly and going on the run from the law, even though he claims he didn't commit a crime.
I mean, it's suspicious.
It's suspicious. For sure. And he's also looks a ton like Cooper and was associated with a railroad, which could have had the titanium.
Dang.
Also, he had a wad of cash. Where'd he get the wad of cash from?
I mean, yeah. Yeah. Who had wads of cash back then?
Who?
Not many.
No. My last note for suspects, I will say, is that some people believe that D.B. Cooper is also the Zodiac
stop
killer.
It. No! No, no, I do not like this theory. I got chills as soon as I saw the Zodiac killer on there. Ugh.
So some people claim that the sketches looked alike.
Oh, God. They do. They do look alike. He has the same hairline and the same ears. Gross.
It's also a police sketch. I don't know how accurate it is. But yeah, some people believe that he's a Zodiac killer. I don't believe this, but some people do.
Well, that was unfortunate to hear.
Sorry about that. Let's end with a fun theory.
Oh, good.
Was D.B. Cooper Canadian?
I think possibly.
Yeah. Because he could have gotten on a plane from Canada, ended up in...
Seattle. It's not that far from the border.
It's really not.
Like, it's like an hour away, driving distance. Which is a Canadian thing. We talk about driving distances in hours, okay?
Apparently Americans don't do that.
I don't know how to talk about it in any other form of time.
No.
Okay? Yeah. It's in about an hour-ish. Yeah.
So there's a few reasons for this. Specifically, he did this on Thanksgiving weekend. American Thanksgiving weekend.
Not Canadian.
No.
We have a different day.
Yeah, we celebrate Thanksgiving in October, and Americans do it in November. So he wouldn't have had, like, the family obligations to, like, go back to.
Mm-hmm.
But he also would have realized that the plane would probably be less populated on this day because of the American holiday surrounding it.
That makes sense. Family would have already, like, arrived.
Yeah, so it's also interesting that he asked specifically for American money, which I don't know if an American would assume otherwise, because why wouldn't they give it to him in American money?
Agreed. Although if I was a Canadian, like, hijacking a Canadian plane, I'd probably ask for American money. In Canada.
You would ask for American money?
It's worth more than Canadian money.
I guess that's why you did it. Oh, but that's interesting.
It's not worth a lot more. It's like 30 cents on a dollar more.
But, I mean, it's a difference when you have, like, $200,000. It's gonna add up, right?
That's true.
So, I'm thinking now, maybe he did that, then immediately, like, crossed the border as quick as possible and got the money switched over so as to get rid of it.
In the FBI files that I skimmed, there was a lot of documents that mentioned Canada. Like, a ton.
Really?
There were letters from people. I mean, again, I didn't go through everything. But in what I saw, it felt like quite a few instances of people mentioning suspects that had moved to Canada, or a letter saying that someone was now in Canada. Like, it's a lot. It was surprising to me, the amount of times it was mentioned.
Weird.
Or that there was one, I don't even know. I don't know who the suspect is, okay? Because they redact so much, you can't even read any of it. But this is a document of someone that they were interviewing where they were connected with this person, and this person moved to Canada and then disappeared. And they couldn't find them again. They were trying to get them for questioning and they just were gone, is my understanding of the document.
Yeah, because, like, especially back in the 70s, there probably wouldn't have been as much communication between the U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Also, no one was reported missing, but I don't know if they would have checked Canadian missing people.
Probably not.
Or if they would have only focused
on... I mean, they should have, but they probably didn't.
Yeah. So if he did go missing in the wilderness and start a new life, they might not know about that.
Mm-hmm.
He also had no accent, which... You might think we have accents, but we don't, and it might not be noticeable, especially, like, I think Western Canada has less of an accent than Eastern Canada.
That's true.
Especially if he's just crossing the border to directly the state below.
Western side, yeah.
Yeah, so they might not have noticed if he had an accent.
Literally, unless he said A. That's the only giveaway that we're from Canada, apparently. Even if you say the words, hey, people are like,
or Canadian. Sorry.
Oh, that's true. Or sorry.
Oh my gosh. The final note I have on Hindi and Canadian, and in general, is the comic book. So, The Adventures of Dan Cooper.
Mm-hmm. It's a French comic book.
Yes. It's a French comic book that wasn't really published widely in the States.
Well, because, I mean, yeah.
It's French.
It makes sense. I don't know anything about anything.
One of our national languages, I believe, is French.
French, yes. We had to learn it in school.
Yeah.
Not that we live in Canada. Canadians have to learn French in school.
I think we've already pinpointed ourselves.
Okay.
We do learn French. Most of us are not fluent. Like, mm-mm. Neither of us are.
However, even though we live in, like, more of a rural area, kind of, it's not a densely populated city, there are still, like, French immersion schools.
There are.
Near us.
Yeah. There, like, every town, every, or, yeah. like, every community has a French immersion school. And it's, like, popular enough that, like, I mean, we could probably pick up a few words here and there, reading it or hearing it.
I could not.
Oh. Well, if we paid attention in school, like I didn't, we could maybe pick that up. And it's also, I think the further you get east towards Quebec, you probably would...
The more...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if this man was from Canada, he could have very easily known French and read this book, The Adventures of Dan Cooper. And Dan Cooper in this book was, like, kind of a thrill seeker. In one of the books, he specifically parachuted.
He's an Air Force pilot? Or he's in the military somehow, and I believe he's a pilot. But he's like a really cool hero pilot who does savior things.
Seems very much like who D.B. Cooper was trying to emulate.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
They're just oddly specific.
Yeah.
Also, there was a lot of speculation about Tina Mucklow possibly being involved.
Yeah.
Just because she was so close, and it was just her and Cooper at the back of the plane for however many minutes while she taught him how to open the stairs. All the passengers were gone, the rest of the crew was in the front.
And it's interesting that she had to, like, teach him.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure this is, like, disproven. This has not gone anywhere.
Okay.
But there was a letter that I read that talks about Cooper having an accomplice. The letter is really obnoxious. Like, so obnoxiously written. Like, I don't know why I'm going on about this. Anyways, that sort of stuff.
Oh.
This letter alludes to the idea that Cooper had an accomplice who was a red-haired lady who was one of the passengers on the plane.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the letter also said something that apparently maybe was not out in the public's viewpoint at that time, which was something about... It was the fact that Cooper originally had asked to take off with the stairs down. Cooper didn't want the stairs pulled back up at all. He wanted, once they were down letting the passengers off, he wanted to just take off with them down, which leads to the idea that Cooper actually originally was planning on getting off the plane shortly after they departed the airport. And that fact wasn't, like, circulated yet.
Interesting.
It's oddly specific. And also, I feel like that makes sense, which is, because why else would he ask to have the stairs down if he wasn't planning on doing it sooner than later?
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, I also feel like Cooper had an accomplice.
I mean, the Zodiac Killer left letters.
Gross.
Horrible. I don't think they're the same people.
I feel like, honestly, when I was reading the letter, I was kind of like, it's very pompous. Almost the way that I feel like the Zodiac Killer wrote his first letter. Or like the Axe of New Orleans person.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they just wrote letters like, you don't need to know, but I know everything. And you're gonna do what I say if you want the truth. And also, here's an opinion of mine. That doesn't matter. I'm gonna leave it there. Now back to what we were talking about before. It's very attitude-y.
Which doesn't feel like D.B. Cooper at all.
No, it doesn't. The letter doesn't claim to be D.B. Cooper. They claim to be someone that knows this information, and they're not gonna tell how they know the information.
Okay, because they're lying.
So annoying. Like, just why? I don't exactly know what I think, but I think Cooper wasn't alone.
You think he had an accomplice?
I do. I think somewhere, somehow, he had an accomplice, and I kind of just have facts, or not facts, pardon me, ideas in my mind that don't make sense.
Okay.
Okay. This is a fact.
Okay.
I'm quite positive that all of the passengers and crew were, like, disproven of having any involvement.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation that the entire flight crew was involved, or that D.B. Cooper didn't exist at all.
That's so funny! I have not heard that, but that was my very first thought.
Really?
When thinking about this, yes, was he felt like a scapegoat, like someone that wasn't actually real.
Really?
Yes.
I don't know if that's true.
I don't think it is.
I don't believe that.
I now think that he's a real person. But when I was first really delving into this, I was like, this is just,
almost
I don't know.
Too perfect.
Yeah.
It's almost too much like a movie.
There's an answer for almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was asked, why are you doing this? Because I have a grudge.
Which sounds like a movie.
Yes.
It sounds fake.
Yeah. It's just, there's, I mean, we have a lot of, there's a lot of information that we're missing, obviously. But we also have a lot of very specific answers,
mm-hmm.
which just feels odd.
Yeah.
So Tina also, I'm pretty sure, because she spent so much time with him, so many people thought that she was involved, to the point that she just does not talk about it anymore. Because, I don't know how, but citizens back then somehow just got where she lived and would, like, come to her house and be like, talk to me about this. Because they didn't believe that she had no involvement. Which is really sad.
People do that to the suspects, too, which is crazy. Just leave them alone.
I mean, it's not your place.
No. Even if she was involved, or they are D.B. Cooper, don't leave it alone.
Yeah.
It's not your place to know.
No. Unless you're the police, or specifically asked by someone in authority to do this.
Which even then, I mean...
I mean, if the FBI asked me to investigate something, I probably would. I'm going to be honest.
I would like to have that authority. D.B. Cooper.
Yes.
We just had, like, a really long rant break that I cut out for sure. Now we're back to talking about this case.
We're trying to regroup, so if we're a little disjointed, that's why.
Final thoughts.
Okay. Final thoughts. Yes, I definitely think somewhere along the line he had an accomplice. Why can't I say that word? An accomplice. Especially because of a few things.
Okay.
One being that the cigarette butts were lost, two being that he may or may not have known that the CIA was using these planes to drop humans into war secretly,
mm-hmm.
which was not common knowledge, right? He either had to have experienced this information himself to know it, or he was fed information, which is and I kind of maybe feel like both equally they could have happened, but if he was fed information, that could explain to me why he chose the parachutes that he did, and also was kind of like, yeah, just fly in this direction. Oh, this fueling point, sure.
Right, like why he was loosey-goosey with some of the details?
Further on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whereas before he was, like we said earlier, so clear and precise.
Hmm.
Fly below this and below this speed.
Hmm.
And like we were talking about before, I did originally feel like it was just a hoax by the crew, which I don't believe anymore. But I kind of wonder if there was someone on that plane that was somehow involved.
Because they wouldn't have known. Why would they have suspected that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, another thing that he knew is he knew flight times. In addition to knowing everything else, he knew, like we talked before, he knew how long it would take to refuel this plane, because fuel comes at this speed.
Mm-hmm.
And he also knew, like, flight times, along with where military bases were and other landmarks around this area. Like, he knew it would take X amount of minutes to get from here to here in this flight.
But he also didn't... It's weird because he knew that stuff, but then he didn't know that they would have needed a stop between there and Mexico City.
Yeah, that's true.
It was like... It's weird because he knows some things so in detail that, like, nobody else would know.
Mm-hmm.
And then some things just, like, slip through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense as he's being fed information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly why he would be fed information, I'm not fully sure, other than some sort of, like, not for greed, like we talked about before. I don't think it would have been for the money, but it would have had to do with something about tarnishing a reputation or ruining someone's career or bringing down a company or a bank or something like that.
There is a theory that I have heard that perhaps this could have been staged by the airline. So as to increase security, like, force increased security in certain measures around the airport, which it did do.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's, like, an idea. Maybe that could have been, and that would also be why the money was never found. He returned it to the airline. They gave him the same amount of money in different bills.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, another point that I forgot to mention earlier. Another reason why I think maybe he could have had an accomplice that, or accomplice that was high up, or was being fed information by someone high up, is because, and I mean someone with ties to certain investigative areas of this whole story, is because I feel like the money was found at a very specific time.
Okay.
Like, it feels like it was planted there. Like, it didn't end up there naturally. Yeah. After he'd fallen out of the plane. It just, like, and it was put there somewhat recently.
Right. Like, somebody held on to it for that long and then put it there.
Specifically, and my theory is because the investigators at the time were getting too close to discovering who it was. So to either throw them off the trail or, like, making them now allocate attention to this instead of what they were doing before. Here's some random money that matches in a different area that's just like a distraction.
Yeah, it's like weird because it's not on the flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not buried so deep that a child couldn't find it.
Yes.
Weird.
There was also a theory that's just a random hiker found in the woods when he was hiking around there, the instructions on how to open the plane door or the airplane stairs, air stairs. But this, I think, was, like, a couple years later, and it was on a piece of paper, and I don't think the paper would have lasted that long.
That's weird. That's weird.
Yeah.
Okay, why would they have instructions, first of all?
I know. Yeah, actually, why would they have written out instructions?
It's not like they're gonna have that posted on the wall of the airplane.
No. And that's why Tina was there specifically to explain how to open. And it's not like she would have just been like, oh, I'm done talking to you. Here's a note.
Yeah.
After speaking to him the whole rest of the time.
Yeah. He could have had an accomplice. It could have been somebody in the CIA specifically, or the government, or from the airline. I'm not saying the airline did any of what I said that they did.
No, or any other, or the CIA, or the government, or the FBI.
No, I don't personally believe that. Unless I do, you will never know. It's just a theory. All of these are just theories.
Yeah. And then the other thing that struck me was in the FBI notes, it also says that the flight never squawked an emergency number. So on the control stations, you squawk codes. So my understanding of it... Has. Yeah. So minors, it's like on the screen will show a blip with a number. And I believe that usually it's a couple of numbers. Like it's your plane number, and then if you're having any sort of anything, you'll squawk like a different code. So like if you're having an emergency on board, you'd squawk 777-7700, I think, is what it said.
Now you know. If the flight attendants ever say that to each other, there's a problem. Now's the time to panic.
Oh, someone opened a door. No. Again, I could not find it, but it's written in the second part that they did not let the ground know that they were having a problem on board the plane until they were transferred to, like, air traffic control. So the first people that they spoke to, they weren't like, hey, we've got a bomber on this plane who's threatening to blow us up unless we do this and this. Because I couldn't find it. I don't know exactly what they said, but they apparently didn't say anything. They just sort of said that they were going to land here and then were transferred over, and then they were like, we've got a problem, we need this and this, and he's demanding blah blah blah.
I wonder what the reason would be.
I don't know either, but then combine that with the idea that he didn't squawk anything, it was very concerning to me.
Yeah, it's such a fun term, squawk. That's interesting. I wonder if like they wanted to not alert or concern as many people as possible.
In the transcriptions, when they were preparing to land, this is the second time now, they did say that they didn't want any flashing lights around the runway.
Right. They didn't want, like, the police to show up with their sirens firing.
And I'm assuming that's because they weren't sure where he was in the plane. And if they had, like, landed and Cooper saw from the plane all these lights, he'd be like,
It might startle him and...
And he might just, like, yeah, decide to just do it. Do the job.
Right. Do the job, which is what he kept saying.
Yeah. So they did specifically mention that. However, I believe that the squawking is just to get the attention of some sort of ground control, like some sort of ground monitoring, so that they would reach out to the plane and go, hey, what's going on?
Right, kind of like an SOS.
Yeah, and then they would better know how to direct them. They wouldn't just ignore them and only talk to them when they're entering a different space or coming too close to another aircraft, or they need to change, like, their...
Right.
Their location.
Kind of like calling 911. They'll walk you through it.
Yeah.
Send you to the right people.
Yeah, and they do it immediately. As soon as they thought, they'd be like, oh, what's going on?
Right.
But they didn't do that. And it's very... I want to know why.
Me too.
It's very clearly like an urgent situation.
Yeah.
Unless the captain was like, oh, this has happened before. We're going to be fine.
It's like, there's no way that's a real bomb.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Dan Cooper? I read those comics.
What do you think happened?
I think that Cooper survived.
Me too.
And I think probably that he did it mostly for the thrill, and that the rest of the money is sitting in someone's attic somewhere.
Oh.
And as to why the money was buried, I think possibly he could have dropped some of it, and then it, like, somehow ended up there. Like, maybe somebody found it and then realized, oh no, this is D.B. Cooper money, and I'm a criminal. I don't want this. Yeah. Or maybe he gave it to someone, and then they were like, oh, he's D.B. Cooper. I need to get rid of this money. I don't know. But I do think that he survived. I don't think that he's alive anymore, because he'd be quite old. I don't think that he's any of the suspects that are currently named, because
I also agree with that.
Yeah, none of them seem exact enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's little things, little details that make each one seem like they wouldn't have been D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, there's enough contradictions that you can, like, kind of rule them out.
Yeah. I do like the theory that he was Canadian, though. There's so much about this case that's just so weird.
There's also so much about it that's, like, literally in Canada. To the point that it makes you believe that some Canada is included somehow. Like,
yeah.
They either fled to Canada or they were in Canada first.
I really believe in the theory that he was Canadian, mostly because I think that would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, he was, like, a gentleman about it. He was, what, the gentleman hijacker?
Yeah, he was, like, so nice, and we have a reputation for being quite nice. At least back then.
Yeah.
I'm very into this case, and I'm so frustrated that we don't know more.
As per usual.
As per usual. I just want to know, like, who was he?
I also really want to know why.
Yeah, like, why? Was it for the money? Was it for the thrill? Was it really for a grudge? I want to know. Tell me. Tell me the truth. D.B. Cooper, if you're out there, reach out. We'd love to interview you. We have thingsofmine@gmail.com. If you think your relative or someone you know is D.B. Cooper, please reach out.
Yeah. We would love to hear from you. We don't have the listening bandwidth that maybe others who have dedicated their lives to D.B. Cooper do, but we are very interested.
And we are so more than willing to entertain the crazy. So in conclusion, to this day, the who, why, and where of D.B. Cooper remain unknown. Enthusiasts still speculate, some even devoting their entire lives to the search. While it's unlikely that he'll ever be found, many still hold out hope. And still others believe that they've cracked the case, adamant that one of the numerous suspects was a man responsible for Norjak. We may never know for sure, but we would absolutely, definitely like to hear your opinion.
Yes.
So please, reach out.
We are on
all the socials, Weird Things in Wine, or some variation thereof. You can find it on our website, weirdthingsinwine.com, or send us an email at weirdthingsinwine@gmail.com. And while you're at it, you might as well just leave a review. We accept 4 and 5 stars. You have options. Thank you.
We don't really mean it. Like, we do, but also we'll accept anything.
I guess that's all, folks.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. It's
been a while. If you made it this far. It's been a while. Glad to be back.
Glad to be back.
We'll be back again soon with something interesting. Equally as interesting, probably.
Something weird.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you. Till next time.
Till next time. Stay weird.
Drink wine.
Cheers. Cheers.
Stick around for some bloopers and outtakes.
We need a team of people.
We need a team of researchers.
We do. Anyone want to apply for the not paid position?
It's an internship.
Have you seen...
A boot.
Have you... Or roof?
Roof! Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I love like air mysteries. Mm. And I love sea mysteries. Foreshadowing. Like if it's not on land, I love it even more, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
But I think he was driven to the airport by his wife, who was like, he was like, I'm going to hijack a plane. And she was like, do it. I dare you. And so he did.
Oh, that's actually really funny. Oh. I love that he's wearing, like, sunglasses in this exact photo.
He's literally cosplaying as D.B. Cooper right now.
Dang. He's literally cosplaying.
Yeah. Do they have cell phones at all? I don't think so. Yeah. So there would have...
And the function could not be overrode from the cockpit. Sorry, my cat's yelling at me.
Shadow.
He's just really interested in this topic.
He was D.B. Cooper. He's reincarnated.
Past life.
The least agile cat I've ever met.
Tell us what you know. Should we, like, do a cat translator app?
Just says, I am D.B. Cooper. The money is buried here. Shadow, please. I could use that money.
Okay. Oh.